Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Dark Tower 7. The Dark Tower by Stephen King. Read by George Guidel.
"1999. Reproduction. Revelation. Redemption. Resumption. Part 1. The Little Red King. Dan Titi. Chapter 1. Callahan and the Vampires. 1. Père Don Callahan had once been the Catholic priest of a town, Salem's Lot had been its name, that no longer existed on any map. He didn't much care. Concepts such as reality had ceased to matter to him. This one-time priest now held a heathen object in his hand, a scrimshaw turtle made of ivory. There was a nick in its beak, and a scratch in the shape of a question mark on its back, but otherwise, it was a beautiful thing. Beautiful and powerful. He could feel the power in his hand, like volts. "How lovely it is," he whispered to the boy who stood with him. "Is it the turtle Maturin? It is, isn't it?" The boy was Jake Chambers, and he'd come a long loop in order to return almost to his starting place here in Manhattan. "I don't know," he said. "She calls it the Sholpada, and it may help us, but it can't kill the harriers that are waiting for us in there." He nodded toward the Dixie Pig, wondering if he meant Susanna or Mia when he used that all-purpose feminine pronoun she. Once he would have said it didn't matter because the two women were so tightly wound together. Now, however, he thought it did matter, or would, soon. "Will you?" Jake asked the pair, meaning, "Will you stand? Will you fight? Will you kill?" "Oh, yes," Callahan said calmly. He put the ivory turtle with its wise eyes and scratched back into his breast pocket with the extra shells for the gun he carried, then patted the cunningly made thing once to make sure it rode safely. "I'll shoot until the bullets are gone. And if I run out of bullets before they kill me, I'll club them with the gun butt." The pause was so slight, Jake didn't even notice it. But in that pause, the white spoke to Father Callahan. It was a force he knew of old, even in boyhood. Although there had been a few years of bad faith along the way, years when his understanding of that elemental force had first grown dim and then become lost completely. But those days were gone. The white was his again, and he told God thank you. Jake was nodding, saying something Callahan barely heard. And what Jake said didn't matter. What that other voice said, the voice of something Gan, perhaps too great to be called God, did. "The boy must go on," the voice told him. "Whatever happens here, however it falls, the boy must go on. Your part in the story is almost done. His is not." They walked past a sign on a chrome post, closed for private function. Jake's special friend Oi trotting between them, his head up and his muzzle wreathed in its usual toothy grin. At the top of the steps, Jake reached into the woven sack Susanna Mio had brought out of Calibrin Sturgis and grabbed two of the plates, the risers. He tapped them together, nodded at the dull ringing sound, and then said, "Let's see yours." Callahan lifted the Ruger Jake had brought out of Cala, New York, and now back into it. "Life is a wheel, and we all say thank you." For a moment, the pair held the Ruger's barrel beside his right cheek like a duelist. Then he touched his breast pocket, bulging with shells and with the turtle, the Sholpada. Jake nodded.
"Once we're in, we stay together. Always together, with Oi between. On three. And once we start, we never stop."
"Never stop."
"Right. Are you ready?"
"Yes. God's love on you, boy."
"And on you, pair. One, two, three."
Jake opened the door, and together they went into the dim light and the sweet, tangy smell of roasting meat. 2. Jake went to what he was sure would be his death, remembering two things Roland Deschain, his true father, had said. Battles that last 5 minutes spawn legends that live 1,000 years. And you needn't die happy when your day comes, but you must die satisfied, for you have lived your life from beginning to end, and Ka is always served. Jake Chambers surveyed the Dixie Pig with a satisfied mind. 3. Also, with crystal clarity, his senses were so heightened that he could smell not just roasting flesh, but the rosemary with which it had been rubbed, could hear not only the calm rhythm of his breath, but the tidal murmur of his blood climbing brainward on one side of his neck and descending heartward on the other. He also remembered Roland saying that even the shortest battle, from first shot to final falling body, seemed long to those taking part. Time grew elastic, stretched to the point of vanishment. Jake had nodded, as if he understood, although he hadn't. Now he did. His first thought was that there were too many of them. Far, far too many. He put their number at close to 100, the majority certainly of the sort Per Callahan had referred to as low men. Some were low women, but Jake had no doubt the principle was the same. Scattered among them, all less fleshy than the low falcon, and some as slender as fencing weapons, their complexions ashy and their bodies surrounded in dim blue auras, were what had to be vampires. Oi stood at Jake's heel, his small, foxy face, stern, whining low in his throat. That smell of cooking meat wafting through the air was not pork. 4. 10 feet between us any time we have 10 feet to give, Pear. So Jake had said out on the sidewalk, and even as they approached the maitre d's platform, Callahan was drifting to Jake's right, putting the required distance between them. Jake had also told him to scream as loud as he could for as long as he could, and Callahan was opening his mouth to begin doing just that, when the voice of the white spoke up inside again. Only one word, but it was enough. Sholpada, it said. Callahan was still holding the Ruger up by his right cheek. Now he dipped into his breast pocket with his left hand. His awareness of the scene before him wasn't as hyper-alert as his young companion's, but he saw a great deal. The orangey-crimson electric flambeaus on the walls, the candles on each table immured in glass containers of a brighter Halloweenish orange, the gleaming napkins. To the left of the dining room was a tapestry showing knights and their ladies sitting at a long banquet table. There was a sense in here. Callahan wasn't sure exactly what provoked it, the various tells and stimuli were too subtle, of people just resettling themselves after some bit of excitement. A small kitchen fire, say, or an automobile accident on the street. Or a lady having a baby, Callahan thought as he closed his hand on the turtle. That's always good for a little pause between the appetizer and the entree. "Now come, Gilead's come-eyes!" shouted an excited, nervous voice. Not a human one. Of that Callahan was almost positive. It was too buzzy to be human. Callahan saw what appeared to be some sort of monstrous bird-human hybrid standing at the far end of the room. It wore straight-leg jeans and a plain white shirt, but the head rising from that shirt was painted with sleek feathers of dark yellow. Its eyes looked like drops of liquid tar. "Get them!" this horridly ridiculous thing shouted, and brushed aside a napkin. Beneath it was some sort of weapon. Callahan supposed it was a gun, but it looked like the sort you saw on Star Trek. What do they call them? Phasers? Stunners? It didn't matter. Callahan had a far better weapon, and wanted to make sure they all saw it. He swept the place settings and the glass container with the candle in it from the nearest table, then snatched away the tablecloth like a magician doing a trick. The last thing he wanted to do was to trip over a swatch of linen at the crucial moment. Then, with a nimbleness he wouldn't have believed even a week ago, he stepped onto one of the chairs and from the chair to the tabletop. Once on the table,
He lifted the shalpada with his fingers supporting the turtle's flat undershell, giving them all a good look at it. "I could croon something," he thought. "Maybe Moonlight Becomes You, or I Left My Heart in San Francisco."
At that point, they had been inside the Dixie Pig for exactly 34 seconds. 5. High school teachers, faced with a large group of students in study hall or a school assembly, would tell you that teenagers, even when freshly showered and groomed, reek of the hormones which their bodies are so busy manufacturing. Any group of people under stress emits a similar stink. And Jake, with his senses tuned to the most exquisite pitch, smelled it here. When they passed the Maitre D's stand, Blackmail Central, his dad liked to call such stations, the smell of the Dixie Pig's diners had been faint, the smell of people coming back to normal after some sort of dust-up. But when the bird creature in the far corner shouted, Jake had smelled the patrons more strongly. It was a metallic aroma, enough like blood to incite his temper and his emotions. Yes, he saw Tweety Bird knock aside the napkin on his table. Yes, he saw the weapon beneath. Yes, he understood that Callahan, standing on the table, was an easy shot. That was of far less concern to Jake than the mobilizing weapon that was Tweety Bird's mouth. Jake was drawing back his right arm, meaning to fling the first of his 19 plates and amputate the head in which that mouth resided when Callahan raised the turtle. "It won't work. Not in here," Jake thought, but even before the idea had been completely articulated in his mind, he understood it was working. He knew by the smell of them. The aggressiveness went out of it, and the few who had begun to rise from their tables, the red holes in the foreheads of the low people gaping, the blue auras of the vampires seeming to pull in and intensify, sat back down again, and hard, as if they had suddenly lost command of their muscles.
"Get them! Those are the ones, sir!"
Then Tweety stopped talking. His left hand, if you could call such an ugly talon a hand, touched the butt of his high-tech gun and then fell away. The brilliance seemed to leave his eyes.
"They're the ones, sir, sir."
Another pause. Then the bird thing said,
"Oh, sigh, what is the lovely thing that you hold?" "You know what it is," Callahan said.
Jake was moving, and Callahan, mindful of what the boy gunslinger had told him outside, "Make sure that every time I look on my right I see your face," stepped back down from the table to move with him, still holding the turtle high. He could almost taste the room's silence, but there was another room. Rough laughter and hoarse, carousing yells, a party from the sound of it, and close by. On the left, from behind the tapestry showing the knights and their ladies at dinner. "Something going on back there," Callahan thought, "and probably not Elk's poker night." He heard Oi breathing fast and low through his perpetual grin, a perfect little engine. And something else. A harsh, rattling sound with a low and rapid clicking beneath. The combination set Callahan's teeth on edge and made his skin feel cold. Something was hiding under the tables. Oi saw the advancing insects first and froze like a dog on point, one paw raised and his snout thrust forward. For a moment, the only part of him to move was the dark and velvety skin of his muzzle, first twitching back to reveal the clenched needles of his teeth, then relaxing to hide them, then twitching back again. The bugs came on. Whatever they were, the turtle maturin upraised in the pear's hand meant nothing to them. A fat guy wearing a tuxedo with plaid lapels spoke weakly, almost questioningly, to the bird thing.
"They weren't to come any further than here, my man, nor to leave. We were told—"
Oi lunged forward, a growl coming through his clamped teeth. It was a decidedly un-Oi-like sound, reminding Callahan of a comic strip balloon.
"Arr!"
"No!" Jake shouted, alarmed. "No, Oi!" At the sound of the boy's shout, the yells and laughter from behind the tapestry abruptly ceased, as if the falcon back there had suddenly become aware that something had changed in the front room. Oi took no notice of Jake's cry. He crunched three of the bugs in rapid succession, the crackle of their breaking carapaces gruesomely clear in the new stillness. He made no attempt to eat them, but simply tossed the corpses, each the size of a mouse, into the air with a snap of the neck and a grinning release of the jaws. And the others retreated back under the tables.
He was made for this, Callahan thought. Perhaps once in the long ago, all bumblers were. Made for it the way some breeds of terrier are made to...
A hoarse shout from behind the tapestry interrupted these thoughts.
Humes! One voice cried, and then a second, Cahumes!
Callahan had an absurd impulse to yell Gesundheit. Before he could yell that or anything else, Roland's voice suddenly filled his head. 6.
Jake, go!
The boy turned toward Per Callahan, bewildered. He was walking with his arms crossed, ready to fling the risers at the first low man or woman who moved. Oi had returned to his heel, although he was swinging his head ceaselessly from side to side, and his eyes were bright with the prospect of more prey.
"We go together," Jake said. "They're buffaloed, Pear. And we're close. They took her through here, this room, and then through the kitchen."
Callahan paid no attention. Still holding the turtle high, as one might hold a lantern in a deep cave, he had turned toward the tapestry. The silence from behind it was far more terrible than the shouts and feverish, gargling laughter. It was silence like a pointed weapon. And the boy had stopped.
"Go while you can,"
Callahan said, striving for calmness.
"Catch up to her if you can. This is the command of your din. This is also the will of the white. But you can't
go, Jake."
The low men and women in the Dixie Pig, whether enthralled to the Sholpada or not, murmured uneasily at the sound of that shout, and well they might have, for it was not Callahan's voice coming from Callahan's mouth.
"You have this one chance and must take it. Find her. As Din, I command you."
Jake's eyes flew wide at the sound of Roland's voice issuing from Callahan's throat. His mouth dropped open. He looked around, dazed. In the second before the tapestry to their left was torn aside, Callahan saw its black joke, what the careless eye would first surely overlook. The roast that was the banquet's main entree had a human form. The knights and their ladies were eating human flesh and drinking human blood. What the tapestry showed was a cannibal's communion. Then the ancient ones, who had been at their own sup, tore aside the obscene tapestry and burst out, shrieking through the great fangs that propped their deformed mouths forever open. Their eyes were as black as blindness, the skin of their cheeks and brows, even the backs of their hands, tumorous with wild teeth. Like the vampires in the dining room, they were surrounded with auras, but these were of a poisoned violet, so dark it was almost black. Some sort of ichor dribbled from the corners of their eyes and mouths. They were gibbering, and several were laughing, seeming not to create the sounds, but rather to snatch them out of the air like something that could be rent alive. And Callahan knew them. Of course he did. Had he not been sent hence by one of their number? Here were the true vampires, the type ones, kept like a secret and now loosed on the intruders. The turtle he held up did not slow them in the slightest. Callahan saw Jake staring, pale, eyes shiny with horror and bulging from their sockets, all purpose forgotten at the sight of these freaks. Without knowing what was going to come out of his mouth until he heard it, Callahan shouted,
"They'll kill Oi first! They'll kill him in front of you and drink his blood!"
Oi barked at the sound of his name. Jake's eyes seemed to clear at the sound, but Callahan had no time to follow the boy's fortunes further.
"Turtle won't stop them, but at least it's holding the others back. Bullets won't stop them, but—"
With a sense of déjà vu. And why not? He had lived all this before in the home of a boy named Mark Petrie. Callahan dipped into the open front of his shirt and brought out the cross he wore there. It clicked against the butt of the Ruger and then hung below it. The cross was lit with a brilliant bluish-white glare. The two ancient things in the lead had been about to grab him and draw him into their midst. Now they drew back instead, shrieking with pain. Callahan saw the surface of their skin sizzle and begin to liquefy. The sight of it filled him with savage happiness.
"Get back from me," he shouted. "The power of God commands you. The power of Christ commands you. The Ka of Midworld commands you. The power of the White commands you."
One of them darted forward, nevertheless, a deformed skeleton in an ancient moss-encrusted dinner suit.
Around its neck it wore some sort of ancient award, the Cross of Malta, perhaps? It swiped one of its long-nailed hands at the crucifix Callahan was holding out. He jerked it down at the last second, and the vampire's claw passed an inch above it. Callahan lunged forward without thought and drove the tip of the cross into the yellow parchment of the thing's forehead. The gold crucifix went in like a red-hot skewer into butter. The thing in the rusty dinner suit let out a liquid cry of pained dismay and stumbled backward. Callahan pulled his cross back. For one moment, before the elderly monster clapped its claws to its brow, Callahan saw the hole his cross had made. Then a thick, curdy, yellow stuff began to spill through the Ancient One's fingers. Its knees unhinged, and it tumbled to the floor between two tables. Its mates shrank away from it, screaming with outrage. The thing's face was already collapsing inward beneath its twisted hands. Its aura whiffed out like a candle, and then there was nothing but a puddle of yellow, liquefying flesh spilling like vomit from the sleeves of its jacket and the legs of its pants. Callahan strode briskly toward the others. His fear was gone. The shadow of shame that had hung over him ever since Barlow had taken his cross and broken it was also gone. "Free at last," he thought. "Free at last! Great God Almighty, I'm free at last! Then I believe this is redemption. And it's good, isn't it? Quite good indeed." "Throw it aside," one of them cried, its hands held up to shield its face. "Nasty bauble of the heap god! Throw it aside if you dare!" "Nasty bauble of the sheep god, indeed. If so, why do you cringe?" Against Barlow, he had not dared answer this challenge, and it had been his undoing. In the Dixie Pig, Callahan turned the cross toward the thing which had dared to speak. "I needn't stake my faith on the challenge of such a thing as you, Si," he said, his words ringing clearly in the room. He had forced the Old Ones back almost to the archway through which they had come. Great dark tumors had appeared on the hands and faces of those in front, eating into the paper of their ancient skin like acid. "And I'd never throw away such an old friend in any case, but put it away, aye, if you like," and he dropped it back into his shirt. Several of the vampires lunged forward immediately, their fang-choked mouths twisting in what might have been grins. Callahan held his hands out toward them. The fingers and the barrel of the Ruger glowed as if they had been dipped into blue fire. The eyes of the turtle had likewise filled with light. Its shell shone. "Stand away from me," Callahan cried. "The power of God and the White commands you." 7. When the terrible shaman turned to face the grandfathers, Maimon of the Tahin felt the turtle's awful, lovely glamour lessen a bit. He saw that the boy was gone, and that filled him with dismay, yet at least he'd gone further in rather than slipping out, so that might still be all right. But if the boy found the door to Fedek and used it, Maimon might find himself in very bad trouble indeed. For Sare answered to Walter O'Dim, and Walter answered only to the Crimson King himself. "Never mind. One thing at a time. Settle the shaman's hash first. Turn the grandfathers loose on him, then go after the boy, perhaps shouting that his friend wanted him after all. That might work." Maimon, the canary man to Mia, Tweety Bird to Jake, crept forward, grasping Andrew, the fat man in the tux with the plaid lapels, with one hand, and Andrew's even fatter Jilly with the other. He gestured at Callahan's turned back. Tirana shook her head vehemently. Maimon opened his beak and hissed at her. She shrank away from him. Detta Walker had already gotten her fingers into the mask Tirana wore, and it hung in shreds about her jaw and neck. In the middle of her forehead, a red wound opened and closed like the gill of a dying fish. Maimon turned to Andrew, released him long enough to point at the shaman, then drew the talon that served him as a hand across his feathered throat in a grimly expressive gesture. Andrew nodded and brushed away his wife's pudgy hands when they tried to restrain him. The mask of humanity was good enough to show the low man in the garish tuxedo visibly gathering his courage. Then he leaped forward with a strangled cry, seizing Callahan around the neck, not with his hands, but his fat forearms. At the same moment, his Jilly lunged and struck the ivory turtle from the pair's hand, screaming as she did so. The Shalpada tumbled to the red rug, bounced beneath one of the tables, and there, like a certain paper boat some of you may remember, passes out of this tale forever.
The grandfathers still held back, as did the Type 3 vampires who had been dining in the public room, but the low men and women sensed weakness and moved in, first hesitantly, then with growing confidence. They surrounded Callahan, paused, and then fell on him in all their numbers. "Let me go in God's name!" Callahan cried, but of course it did no good. Unlike the vampires, the things with the red wounds in their foreheads did not respond to the name of Callahan's god. All he could do was hope Jake wouldn't stop, let alone double back, that he and Oi would go like the wind to Susanna, save her if they could, die with her if they could not, and kill her baby, if chance allowed. God help him, but he had been wrong about that. They should have snuffed out the baby's life back in the collar when they had the chance. Something bit deeply into his neck. The vampires would come now, cross or no cross. They'd fall on him like the sharks they were once they got their first whiff of his life's blood. "Help me, God! Give me strength," Callahan thought, and felt the strength flow into him. He rolled to his left as claws ripped into his shirt, tearing it to ribbons. For a moment his right hand was free, and the Ruger was still in it. He turned it toward the working, sweaty, hate-congested face of the fat one named Andrew, and placed the barrel of the gun, bought for home protection in the long-distant past by Jake's more than a little paranoid TV executive father, against the soft red wound in the center of the low man's forehead. "No, you daren't!" Tirana cried, and as she reached for the gun, the front of her gown finally burst, spilling her massive breasts free. They were covered with coarse fur. Callahan pulled the trigger. The Ruger's report was deafening in the dining room. Andrew's head exploded like a gourd filled with blood, spraying the creatures who had been crowding in behind him. There were screams of horror and disbelief. Callahan had time to think. "It wasn't supposed to be this way, was it? And is it enough to put me in a club? Am I a gunslinger yet?" Perhaps not. But there was the Birdman, standing right in front of him between two tables, its beak opening and closing, its throat beating visibly with excitement. Smiling, propping himself on one elbow as blood pumped onto the carpet from his torn throat, Callahan leveled Jake's Ruger. "No!" Maimon cried, raising his misshapen hands to his face in an utterly fruitless gesture of protection. "No, you can't!" "Can so," Callahan thought with childish glee, and fired again. Maimon took two stumble steps backward, then a third. He struck a table and collapsed on top of it. Three yellow feathers hung above him on the air, seesawing lazily. Callahan heard savage howls, not of anger or fear, but of hunger. The aroma of blood had finally penetrated the old one's jaded nostrils, and nothing would stop them now. So, if he didn't want to join them, Pear Callahan, once Father Callahan of Salem's Lot, turned the Ruger's muzzle on himself. He wasted no time looking for eternity in the darkness of the barrel, but placed it deep against the shelf of his chin. "Heil Roland," he said, and knew, the wave, they are lifted by the wave, that he was heard. "Heil Gunslinger!" His finger tightened on the trigger as the ancient monsters fell upon him. He was buried in the reek of their cold and bloodless breath, but not daunted by it. He had never felt so strong. Of all the years in his life, he had been happiest when he had been a simple vagrant, not a priest, but only Callahan of the Rhodes, and felt that soon he would be let free to resume that life, and wander as he would, his duties fulfilled, and that was well. "May you find your tower, Roland, and breach it, and may you climb to the top!" The teeth of his old enemies, these ancient brothers and sisters of a thing which had called itself Kurt Barlow, sank into him like stingers. Callahan felt them not at all. He was smiling as he pulled the trigger and escaped them for good. Chapter 2. Lifted on the Wave. 1. On their way out along the dirt camp road, which had taken them to the writer's house in the town of Bridgeton, Eddie and Roland came upon an orange pickup truck with the words "Central Maine Power Maintenance" painted on the sides. Nearby, a man in a yellow hard hat and an orange high-visibility vest was cutting branches that threatened the low-hanging electrical lines. And did Eddie feel something then? Some gathering force?
maybe a precursor of the wave rushing down the path of the beam toward them? He later thought so, but couldn't say for sure. God knew he'd been in a weird enough mood already, and why not? How many people get to meet their creators? Well, Stephen King hadn't created Eddie Dean, a young man whose co-op city happened to be in Brooklyn rather than the Bronx, not yet, not in that year of 1977. But Eddie felt certain that in time King would. How else could he be here? Eddie nipped in ahead of the power truck, got out, and asked the sweating man with the brush hog in his hands for directions to Turtleback Lane in the town of Lovell. The Central Maine power guy passed on the directions willingly enough, then added, "If you're serious about going to Lovell today, you're going to have to use Route 93. The Bog Road, some folks call it." He raised a hand to Eddie and shook his head like a man forestalling an argument, although Eddie had not in fact said a word since asking his original question. "It's 7 miles longer, I know, and jouncy as a bugger, but you can't get through East Stoneham today. Cops have got it blocked off. State bears, local yokels, even the Oxford County Sheriff's Department." "You're kidding," Eddie said. It seemed a safe enough response. The power guy shook his head grimly. "No one seems to know exactly what's up, but there's been shooting. Automatic weapons, maybe, and explosions." He patted the battered and sawdusty walkie-talkie clip to his belt. "I've even heard the T-word once or twice this afternoon. Not surprised, either." Eddie had no idea what the T-word might be, but knew Roland wanted to get going. He could feel the gunslinger's impatience in his head, could almost see Roland's impatient finger-twirling gesture, the one that meant, "Let's go, let's go."
"I'm talking about terrorism," the power guy said, then lowered his voice. "People don't think shit like that can happen in America, buddy, but I got news for you. It can. If not today, then sooner or later. Someone's going to blow up the Statue of Liberty or the Empire State Building. That's what I think. The right-wingers, the left-wingers, or the goddamn Arabs. Too many crazy people."
Eddie, who had a nodding acquaintance with 10 more years of history than this fellow, nodded.
"You're probably right. In any case, thanks for the info."
"Just trying to save you some time."
And as Eddie opened the driver's side door of John Cullum's Ford sedan,
"You been in a fight, mister? You look kind of bunged up. Also, you're limping."
Eddie had been in a fight, all right. Had been grooved in the arm and plugged in the right calf. Neither wound was serious, and in the forward rush of events, he had nearly forgotten them. Now they hurt all over again. Why in God's name had he turned down Aaron Deepnose's bottle of Percocet tablets?
"Yeah," he said. "That's why I'm going to Lovell. Guy's dog bit me. He and I are going to have a talk about it."
Bizarre story. Didn't have much going for it in the way of plot. But he was no writer. That was King's job. In any case, it was good enough to get him back behind the wheel of Cullum's Ford Galaxy before the power guy could ask him any more questions. And Eddie reckoned that made it a success. He drove away quickly. "You got directions?" Roland asked.
"Yeah."
"Good. Everything's breaking at once, Eddie. We have to get to Susanna as fast as we can. Jake and Per Callahan, too. And the baby's coming. Whatever it is. May have come already."
"Turn right when you get back out to Kansas Road," the power guy had told Eddie. "Kansas as in Dorothy, Toto, and Auntie M. Everything breaking at once." And he did. That put them rolling north. The sun had gone behind the trees on their left, throwing the two-lane blacktop entirely into shadow. Eddie had an almost palpable sense of time slipping through his fingers like some fabulously expensive cloth that was too smooth to grip. He stepped on the gas, and Cullum's old Ford, although wheezy in the valves, walked out a little. Eddie got it up to 55 and pegged it there. More speed might have been possible, but Kansas Road was both twisty and badly maintained. Roland had taken a sheet of notepaper from his shirt pocket, unfolded it, and was now studying it, although Eddie doubted if the gunslinger could actually read much of the document. This world's written words would always be mostly mystery to him. At the top of the paper, above Aaron Deepnose's rather shaky but perfectly legible handwriting, and Calvin Towers' all-important signature, was a smiling cartoon beaver, and the words, "Damn important things to do." A silly pun if ever there was one. "I don't like silly questions. I won't play silly games," Eddie thought,
and suddenly grinned. It was a point of view to which Roland still held, Eddie felt quite sure, notwithstanding the fact that, while riding Blaine the Mono, their lives had been saved by a few well-timed silly questions. Eddie opened his mouth to point out that what might well turn out to be the most important document in the history of the world, more important than the Magna Carta or the Declaration of Independence or Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, was headed by a dumb pun. And how did Roland like them apples? Before he could get out a single word, however, the wave struck. 2. His foot slipped off the gas pedal, and that was good. If it had stayed on, both he and Roland would surely have been injured, maybe killed. When the wave came, staying in control of John Cullum's Ford Galaxy dropped all the way off Eddie Dean's list of priorities. It was like that moment when the roller coaster has reached the top of its first mountain, hesitates a moment, tilts, plunges, and you fall with a sudden blast of hot summer air in your face and a pressure against your chest and your stomach floating somewhere behind you. In that moment, Eddie saw everything in Cullum's car had come untethered and was floating. Pipe ashes, two pens and a paperclip from the dashboard, Eddie's din, and, he realized, his din's Kamai, good old Eddie Dean. No wonder he had lost his stomach. He wasn't aware that the car itself, which had drifted to a stop at the side of the road, was also floating, tilting lazily back and forth 5 or 6 inches above the ground, like a small boat on an invisible sea. Then the tree-lined country road was gone. Bridgeton was gone. The world was gone. There was the sound of toad ash chimes, repulsive and nauseating, making him want to grit his teeth in protest. Except his teeth were gone, too. 3. Like Eddie, Roland had a clear sense of being first lifted and then hung like something that had lost its ties to Earth's gravity. He heard the chimes and felt himself elevated through the wall of existence, but he understood this wasn't real toad ash, at least not of the sort they'd experienced before. This was very likely what Vanney called avenkau, words which meant lifted on the wind or carried on the wave. Only the kal form, instead of the more usual kas, indicated a natural force of disastrous proportions, not a wind, but a hurricane. Not a wave, but a tsunami.
"The very beam means to speak to you, Gabby," Vanney said in his mind. Gabby, the old sarcastic nickname Vanney had adopted because Stephen Deschain's boy was so close-mouthed. His limping, brilliant tutor had stopped using it, probably at Court's insistence, the year Roland had turned 11. "You would do well to listen, if it does."
"I will listen very well," Roland replied, and was dropped. He gagged, weightless and nauseated. More chimes. Then suddenly, he was floating again, this time above a room filled with empty beds. One look was enough to assure him that this was where the wolves brought the children they kidnapped from the borderland Kalas. At the far end of the room, a hand grasped his arm, a thing Roland would have thought impossible in this state. He looked to his left and saw Eddie beside him, floating, naked. They were both naked, their clothes left behind in the writer's world. Roland had already seen what Eddie was pointing to. At the far end of the room, a pair of beds had been pushed together. A white woman lay on one of them. Her legs, the very ones Susanna had used on their toad ash visit to New York, Roland had no doubt, were spread wide. A woman with the head of a rat, one of the Taheen, he felt sure, bent between them. Next to the white woman was a dark-skinned one whose legs ended just below the knees. Floating naked or not, nauseated or not, toad ash or not, Roland had never in his life been so glad to see anyone. And Eddie felt the same. Roland heard him cry out joyfully in the center of his head and reached a hand to still the younger man. He had to still him, for Susanna was looking at them, had almost certainly seen them, and if she spoke to them, he needed to hear every word she said. Because although those words would come from her mouth, it would very likely be the beam that spoke. The voice of the bear, or that of the turtle. Both women wore metal hoods over their hair. A length of segmented steel hose connected them. Some kind of Vulcan mind meld, Eddie said, once again filling the center of his head and blotting out everything else. Or maybe...
Hush, Roland broke in. Hush, Eddie, for your father's sake.
A man wearing a white coat seized a pair of cruel-looking forceps from a tray and pushed the redhead Tahin nurse aside. He bent, peering up between Mia's legs and holding the forceps above his head. Standing close by, wearing a T-shirt with words of Eddie and Susanna's world on it, was a Tahin with the head of a fierce brown bird.
He'll sense us, Roland thought, if we stay long enough. He'll surely sense us and raise the alarm.
But Susanna was looking at him, the eyes below the clamp of the hood feverish, bright with understanding.
Seeing them, I say true.
She spoke a single word, and in a moment of inexplicable but perfectly reliable intuition, Roland understood the word came not from Susanna, but from Mia. Yet it was also the voice of the beam, a force perhaps sentient enough to understand how seriously it was threatened and to want to protect itself.
Chasset was the word Susanna spoke.
He heard it in his head, because they were Ka-Tet and An-Tet. He also saw it form soundlessly on her lips as she looked up toward the place where they floated. Onlookers at something that was happening in some other where and when, at this very moment. The hawk-headed Tahin looked up, perhaps following her gaze, perhaps hearing the chimes with its preternaturally sharp ears. Then the doctor lowered his forceps and thrust them beneath Mia's gown. She shrieked, Susanna shrieked with her, and as if Roland's essentially bodiless being could be pushed away by the force of those combined screams like a milkweed pod lifted and carried on a gust of October wind, the gunslinger felt himself rise violently, losing touch with this place as he went, but holding on to that one word. It brought with it a brilliant memory of his mother leaning over him as he lay in bed. In the room of many colors this had been, the nursery. And of course now he understood the colors he'd only accepted as a young boy, accepted as children barely out of their clouts accept everything, with unquestioning wonder, with the unspoken assumption that it's all magic. The windows of the nursery had been stained glass, representing the bends of the rainbow, of course. He remembered his mother leaning toward him, her face pied with that lovely, various light, her hood thrown back, so he could trace the curve of her neck with the eye of a child, it's all magic, and the soul of a lover. He remembered thinking how he would court her and win her from his father, if she would have him. How they would marry and have children of their own, and live forever in that fairy-tale kingdom called the All-Aglow. And how she sang to him.
How Gabrielle Duchesne sang to her little boy, with his big eyes looking solemnly up at her from his pillow, and his face already stamped with the many swimming colors of his wandering life, singing a lilting nonsense song that went like this.
Baby bunting, baby dear, baby bring your berries here. Chusset, chisset, chasset. Bring enough to fill your basket.
Enough to fill my basket, he thought, as he was flung, weightless, through darkness and the terrible sound of the Todash chimes. The words weren't quite nonsense, but old numbers. She'd told him once when he had asked, Chusset, Chisset, Chasset, 17, 18, 19.
Chasset is 19, he thought. Of course. It's all 19.
Then he and Eddie were in light again, a fever-sick orange light, and there were Jake and Callahan. He even saw Oi standing at Jake's left heel, his fur bushed out and his muzzle wrinkled back to show his teeth.
Chusset, chisset, chasset, Roland thought as he looked at his son, a boy so small and terribly outnumbered in the dining room of the Dixie Pig.
Chasset is 19, enough to fill my basket.
But what basket? What does it mean?
4. Beside Kansas Road in Bridgeton, John Cullum's 12-year-old Ford, 106,000 on the odometer, and she was just getting warmed up, Cullum liked to tell people, seesawed lazily back and forth above the soft shoulder, front tires touching down and then rising so the back tires could briefly kiss the dirt. Inside, two men who appeared not only unconscious but transparent rolled lazily with the car's motion like corpses in a sunken boat. and around them floated the debris which collect in any old car that's been hard used. The ashes and pens and paper clips and the world's oldest peanut and a penny from the back seat and pine needles from the floor mats, and even one of the floor mats itself. In the darkness of the glove compartment, objects rattled timidly against the closed door. Someone passing would undoubtedly have been thunderstruck at the sight of all this stuff and people. People who might be dead, floating around in the car like jetsam in a space capsule. But no one did come along. Those who lived on this side of Long Lake were mostly looking across the water toward the East Stoneham side, even though there was really nothing over there to see any longer. Even the smoke was almost gone. Lazily, the car floated, and inside it, Roland of Gilead rose slowly to the ceiling, where his neck pressed against the dirty roof liner, and his legs cleared the front seat to trail out behind him. Eddie was first held in place by the wheel, but then some random sideways motion of the car slid him free, and he also rose, his face slack and dreaming. A silver line of drool escaped the corner of his mouth and floated, shining and full of minuscule bubbles, beside one blood-crusted cheek. 5. Roland knew that Susanna had seen him, had probably seen Eddie as well. That was why she'd labored so hard to speak that single word. Jake and Callahan, however, saw neither of them. The boy and the pair had entered the Dixie Pig, a thing that was either very brave or very foolish, and now all of their concentration was necessarily focused on what they'd found there. Foolhardy or not, Roland was fiercely proud of Jake.
He saw the boy had established candor between himself and Callahan.
That distance, never the same in any two situations, which assures that a pair of outnumbered gunslingers cannot be killed by a single shot. Both had come ready to fight. Callahan was holding Jake's gun, and another thing as well, some sort of carving. Roland was almost sure it was a Kanta, one of the little gods. The boy had Susanna's risers and their tote sack, retrieved from only the gods knew where. The gunslinger spied a fat woman whose humanity ended at the neck. Above her trio of flabby chins, the mask she'd been wearing hung in ruins. Looking at the rathead beneath, Roland suddenly understood a good many things. Some might have come clearly to him sooner had not his attention, like that of the boy and the pair at this very moment, been focused on other matters.
Callahan's low men, for instance. There might well be Taheen, creatures neither of the prim nor of the natural world, but misbegotten things from somewhere between the two. They certainly weren't the sort of beings Roland called slow mutants, for those had arisen as a result of the old ones' ill-advised wars and disastrous experiments. No, they might be genuine Taheen, sometimes known as the Third People or the Kantoi, and yes, Roland should have known. How many of the Taheen now served the being known as the Crimson King? Some? Many?
All? If the third answer was the correct one, Roland reckoned the road to the tower would be difficult indeed. But to look beyond the horizon was not much in the gunslinger's nature, and in this case, his lack of imagination was surely a blessing. 6. He saw what he needed to see. Although the Kantoi, Callahan's low folk, had surrounded Jake and Callahan on all sides, the two of them hadn't even seen the duo behind them, the ones who'd been guarding the doors to 61st Street. The pair had frozen them with the carving, just as Jake had been able to freeze and fascinate people with the key he'd found in the vacant lot.
A yellow Taheen, with the body of a man and the head of a wazo, had some sort of gun near at hand, but made no effort to grab it.
Yet there was another problem. One Roland's eye, trained to see every possible snare and ambush, fixed upon at once. He saw the blasphemous parody of Eld's Last Fellowship on the wall, and understood its significance completely in the seconds before it was ripped away. And the smell, not just flesh, but human flesh. This, too, he would have understood earlier, had he had time to think about it. Only life in Calibrin Sturgis had allowed him little time to think. In the Kala, as in a storybook, life had been one damned thing after another. Yet it was clear enough now, wasn't it?
The low folk might only be Taheen, a child's ogres, if it did you.
Those behind the tapestry were what Callahan had called Type 1 vampires, and what Roland himself knew as the Grandfathers, perhaps the most gruesome and powerful survivors of the Prim's long-ago recession. And while such as the Taheen might be content to stand as they were, gawking at the sigil Callahan held up, the Grandfathers wouldn't spare it a second glance. Now, clattering bugs came pouring out from under the table. They were of a sort Roland had seen before, and any doubts he might still have held about what was behind that tapestry departed at the sight of them. They were parasites, blood drinkers, camp followers, grandfather fleas. Probably not dangerous while there was a bumbler present, but of course, when you spy the little doctors in such numbers, the grandfathers were never far behind. As Oi charged at the bugs, Roland of Gilead did the only thing he could think of. He swam down to Callahan. Into Callahan. 7.
Pear, I am here. Aye, Roland, what? No time. Get him out of here. You must. Get him out while there's still time.
8. And Callahan tried. The boy, of course, didn't want to go. Looking at him through the pair's eyes, Roland thought with some bitterness, I should have schooled him better in betrayal. Yet all the gods know I did the best I could.
Go while you can,
Callahan told Jake, striving for calmness.
Catch up to her if you can. This is the command of your din. This is also the will of the White.
It should have moved him, but it didn't. He still argued. Gods, he was nearly as bad as Eddie, and Roland could wait no longer.
Pear, let me.
Roland seized control without waiting for a reply. He could already feel the wave, the Aven Kal, beginning to recede. And the grandfathers would come at any second.
Go, Jake,
he cried, using the pear's mouth and vocal cords like a loudspeaker. If he had thought about how one might do something like this, he would have been lost completely, but thinking about things had also never been his way, and he was grateful to see the boy's eyes flash wide.
You have this one chance and must take it. Find her. As Din, I command you.
Then, as in the hospital ward with Susanna, he felt himself once more tossed upward like something without weight, blown out of Callahan's mind and body like a bit of cobweb or a fluff of dandelion thistle. For a moment he tried to flail his way back like a swimmer trying to buck a strong current just long enough to reach the shore, but it was impossible.
Roland!
That was Eddie's voice, and filled with dismay.
Jesus, Roland, what in God's name are those things?
The tapestry had been torn aside. The creatures which rushed out were ancient and freakish, their warlock faces warped, with teeth growing wild, their mouths propped open by fangs as thick as the gunslinger's wrists, their wrinkled and stubbled chins slick with blood and scraps of meat. And still, gods, oh gods, the boy remained.
They'll kill Oi first,
Callahan shouted. Only Roland didn't think it was Callahan. He thought it was Eddie, using Callahan's voice as Roland had. Somehow Eddie had found either smoother currents or more strength, enough to get inside after Roland had been blown out.
They'll kill him in front of you and drink his blood.
It was finally enough. The boy turned and fled with Oi running beside him. He cut directly in front of the Wazo Taheen and between two of the low Falcon, but none made any effort to grab him.
They were still staring at the raised turtle on Callahan's palm, mesmerized. The grandfathers paid no attention to the fleeing boy at all, as Roland had felt sure they would not. He knew from Per Callahan's story that one of the grandfathers had come to the little town of Salem's Lot, where the pair had for a while preached. The pair had lived through the experience, not common for those who faced such monsters after losing their weapons and sigils of power, but the thing had forced Callahan to drink of its tainted blood before letting him go. It had marked him for these others. Callahan was holding his cross sigil out toward them, but before Roland could see anything else, he was exhaled back into darkness. The chimes began again, all but driving him mad with their awful tintinnabulation. Somewhere, faintly, he could hear Eddie shouting. Roland reached for him in the dark, brushed Eddie's arm, lost it, found his hand, and seized it. They rolled over and over, clutching each other, trying not to be separated, hoping not to be lost in the doorless dark between the worlds. Chapter 3 Eddie Makes a Call. 1. Eddie returned to John Cullum's old car the way he'd sometimes come out of nightmares as a teenager, tangled up and panting with fright, totally disoriented, not sure who he was, let alone where. He had a second to realize that, incredible as it seemed, he and Roland were floating in each other's arms like unborn twins in the womb. Only this was no womb. A pen and a paperclip were drifting in front of his eyes. So was a yellow plastic case he recognized as an 8-track tape.
"Don't waste your time, John," he thought. "No true thread there. That's a dead-end gadget if there ever was one."
Something was scratching the back of his neck. Was it the dome light of John Cullum's scourgy old galaxy? By God, he thought it was. Then gravity reasserted itself, and they fell, with meaningless objects raining down all around them. The floor mat which had been floating around in the Ford's cabin landed draped over the steering wheel. Eddie's midsection hit the top of the front seat, and air exploded out of him in a rough whoosh. Roland landed beside him, and on his bad hip he gave a single barking cry and then began to pull himself back into the front seat. Eddie opened his mouth to speak. Before he could, Callahan's voice filled his head.
"Heil, Roland! Heil, Gunslinger!"
How much psychic effort had it cost the pair to speak from that other world? And behind it, faint but there, the sound of bestial, triumphant cries. Howls that were not quite words. Eddie's wide and startled eyes met Roland's faded blue ones. He reached out for the gunslinger's left hand, thinking,
"He's going. Great God, I think the pair is going."
"May you find your tower, Roland, and breach it."
"And may you climb to the top," Eddie breathed. They were back in John Cullum's car and parked, askew but otherwise peacefully enough, at the side of Kansas Road in the shady early evening hours of a summer's day. But what Eddie saw was the orange hell light of that restaurant that wasn't a restaurant at all, but a den of cannibals. The thought that there could be such things, that people walked past their hiding place each and every day, not knowing what was inside, not feeling the greedy eyes that perhaps marked them and measured them. Then, before he could think further, he cried out with pain as phantom teeth settled into his neck and cheeks and midriff, as his mouth was violently kissed by nettles and his testicles were skewered. He screamed, clawing at the air with his free hand until Roland grabbed it and forced it down.
"Stop, Eddie, stop. They're gone."
A pause. The connection broke, and the pain faded. Roland was right, of course. Unlike the pair, they had escaped. Eddie saw that Roland's eyes were shiny with tears.
"He's gone, too. The pair."
"The vampires? You know, the cannibals? Did they?
Eddie couldn't finish the thought. The idea of Pere Callahan as one of them was too awful to speak aloud.
"No, Eddie. Not at all. He..."
Roland pulled the gun he still wore. The scrolled steel sides gleamed in the late light. He tucked the barrel deep beneath his chin for a moment, looking at Eddie as he did it.
"He escaped them," Eddie said.
"Aye. And how angry they must be."
Eddie nodded, suddenly exhausted, and his wounds were aching again. No, sobbing.
"Good," he said. "Now put that thing back where it belongs before you shoot yourself with it."
And as Roland did,
"What just happened to us? Did we go toe-dash, or was it another beam quake?"
"I think it was a bit of both," Roland said. "There's a thing called Avenkal, which is like a tidal wave that runs along the path of the beam. We were lifted on it,
and allowed to see what we wanted to see."
Roland thought about this for a moment, then shook his head with great firmness.
"We saw what the beam wanted us to see, where it wants us to go."
"Roland, did you study this stuff when you were a kid? Did your old pal Van A teach classes in, I don't know, the anatomy of beams and bends of the rainbow?"
Roland was smiling.
"Yes, I suppose that we were taught such things in both history and summa logicalis."
"Logica what?"
Roland didn't answer. He was looking out the window of Cullum's car, still trying to get his breath back, both the physical and the figurative. It really wasn't that hard to do, not here. Being in this part of Bridgeton was like being in the neighborhood of a certain vacant lot in Manhattan. because there was a generator near here, not Psi King, as Roland had first believed, but the potential of Psi King, of what Psi King might be able to create, given world enough and time. Wasn't King also being carried on Aven-Kal, perhaps generating the very wave that lifted him? A man can't pull himself up by his own bootstraps, no matter how hard he tries, Court had lectured when Roland, Cuthbert, Alan, and Jamie had been little more than toddlers. Court, speaking in the tone of cheery self-assurance that had gradually hardened to harshness as his last group of lads grew toward their trials of manhood. But maybe about bootstraps, Court had been wrong. Maybe, under certain circumstances, a man could pull himself up by them, or give birth to the universe from his navel, as Gan was said to have done. As a writer of stories, was King not a creator? And at bottom, wasn't creation about making something from nothing, seeing the world in a grain of sand, or pulling oneself up by one's own bootstraps? And what was he doing, sitting here and thinking long philosophical thoughts while two members of his tent were lost? "Get this carriage going," Roland said, trying to ignore the sweet humming he could hear, whether the voice of the beam or the voice of Gan the Creator, he didn't know. "We've got to get to Turtleback Lane in this town of Lovell, and see if we can't find our way through to where Susanna is." And not just for Susanna, either. If Jake succeeded in eluding the monsters in the Dixie Pig, he would also head to where she lay. Of this Roland had no doubt. Had he reached for the transmission lever? Despite all its gyrations, Cullum's old galaxy had never quit running, and then his hand fell away from it. He turned and looked at Roland with a bleak eye. "What ails thee, Eddie? Whatever it is, spill it quick. The baby's coming now, may have come already. Soon they'll have no more use for her."
"I know," Eddie said. "But we can't go to Lovell."
He grimaced as if what he was saying was causing him physical pain. Roland guessed it probably was.
"Not yet."
2. They sat quiet for a moment, listening to the sweetly tuned hum of the beam, a hum that sometimes became joyous voices. They sat looking into the thickening shadows in the trees, where a million faces and a million stories lurked. Oh, can you say unfound door? Can you say lost? Eddie half expected Roland to shout at him, it wouldn't be the first time, or maybe clout him upside the head as the gunslinger's old teacher, Court, had been wont to do when his pupils were slow or contrary. Eddie almost hoped he would. A good shot to the jaw might clear his head, by Shardik. "Only muddy thinking's not the trouble, and you know it," he thought. "Your head is clearer than his. If it wasn't, you could let go of this world and go on hunting for your lost wife." At last Roland spoke. "What is it, then? This?" He bent and picked up the folded piece of paper with Aaron Deepnose's pinched handwriting on it. Roland looked at it for a moment, then flicked it into Eddie's lap with a little grimace of distaste.
"You know how much I love her,"
Eddie said in a low, strained voice.
"You know that."
Roland nodded, but without looking at him. He appeared to be staring down at his own broken and dusty boots and the dirty floor of the passenger side footwell. Those downcast eyes, that gaze, which would not turn to him who'd come almost to idolize Roland of Gilead, sort of broke Eddie Dean's heart. Yet he pressed on. If there had ever been room for mistakes, it was gone now. This was the end game.
"I'd go to her this minute if I thought it was the right thing to do. Roland, this second. But we have to finish our business in this world, because this world is one way. Once we leave today, July 9th, 1977, we can never come here again.
Eddie, we've been through all of this." Still not looking at him.
"Yes, but do you understand it? Only one bullet to shoot, one riser to throw. That's why we came to Bridgeton in the first place. God knows I wanted to go to Turtleback Lane as soon as John Cullum told us about it, but I thought we had to see the writer and talk to him, and I was right, wasn't I?"
Almost pleading now.
"Wasn't I?"
Roland looked at him at last, and Eddie was glad. This was hard enough, wretched enough, without having to bear the turned-away, downcast gaze of his din.
and it may not matter if we stay a little longer. If we concentrate on those two women lying together on those two beds, Roland, if we concentrate on Suze and Mia as we last saw them, then it's possible we can cut into their history at that point, isn't it?
After a long, considering moment, during which Eddie wasn't conscious of drawing a single breath, the gunslinger nodded. Such could not happen if on Turtleback Lane they found what the gunslinger had come to think of as an old one's door, because such doors were dedicated and always came out at the same place. But were they to find a magic door somewhere along Turtleback Lane in Lovell, one that had been left behind when the Prim receded, then yes, they might be able to cut in where they wanted. But such doors could be tricky, too. This they had found out for themselves in the Cave of Voices, when the door there had sent Jake and Callahan to New York instead of Roland and Eddie, thereby scattering all their plans into the land of 19.
"What else must we do?" Roland said.
There was no anger in his voice, but to Eddie, he sounded both tired and unsure. "Whatever it is, it's going to be hard. That much I guarantee you."
Eddie took the bill of sale and gazed at it as grimly as any Hamlet in the history of drama had ever stared upon the skull of poor Yorick. Then he looked back at Roland.
"This gives us title to the vacant lot with the rose in it. We need to get it to Moses Carver of Holmes Dental Industries. And where is he? We don't know."
"For that matter, Eddie, we don't even know if he's still alive."
Eddie voiced a wild laugh.
"You say true, I say thank you. Why don't I turn us around, Roland? I'll drive us back to Stephen King's house. We can cadge 20 or 30 bucks off him, because, brother, I don't know if you noticed, but we don't have a crying dime between the two of us. But more important, we can get him to write us a really good hard-boiled private eye. Someone who looks like Bogart and kicks ass like Clint Eastwood. Let him track down this guy Carver for us."
He shook his head as if to clear it. The hum of the voices sounded sweetly in his ears, the perfect antidote to the ugly toad-ash chimes.
"I mean, my wife is in bad trouble somewhere up the line. For all I know, she's being eaten alive by vampires or vampire bugs. And here I sit beside a country road with a guy whose most basic skill is shooting people, trying to work out how I'm going to start a fucking corporation."
"Slow down,"
Roland said. Now that he was resigned to staying in this world a little longer, he seemed calm enough.
"Tell me what it is you feel we need to do before we can shake the dirt of this where and when from our heels for good."
So, Eddie did. 3. Roland had heard a good deal of it before, but hadn't fully understood what a difficult position they were in. They owned the vacant lot on Second Avenue, yes, but their basis for ownership was a holographic document that would look mighty shaky in a court of legal, especially if the powers that be from the Sombra Corporation started throwing lawyers at them. Eddie wanted to get the writ of trade to Moses Carver if he could, along with the information that his goddaughter, Odetta Holmes, missing for 13 years by the summer of 1977, was alive and well, and wanted above all things for Carver to assume guardianship not just of the vacant lot itself, but of a certain rose growing wild within its borders. Moses Carver, if still alive, had to be convinced enough by what he heard to fold the so-called Tet Corporation into Holmes Industries, or vice versa. More, he had to dedicate what was left of his life, and Eddie had an idea Carver might be Aaron Deepnose age by now, to building a corporate giant whose only real purpose was to thwart two other corporate giants, Sombra and North Central Positronics, at every turn. To strangle them, if possible, and keep them from becoming a monster that would leave its destroyer's track across all the dying expanse of Midworld and mortally wound the Dark Tower itself.
"Maybe we should have left the writ of trade with Cy Deepnose," Roland mused when he had heard Eddie through to the end. "At least he could have located this Carver and sought him out and told our tale for us."
"No, we did right to keep it."
This was one of the few things of which Eddie was completely sure.
"If we'd left this piece of paper with Aaron Deepnose, it'd be ashes in the wind by now."
"You believe Tower would have repented his bargain and talked his friend into destroying it?"
"I know it," Eddie said. "But even if Deepnose could stand up to his old friend going yada 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 in his ear for hours on end, Burn it, Aaron. They coerced me, and now they mean to screw me. You know it as well as I do. Burn it, and we'll call the cops on those momsers. Do you think Moses Carver would believe such a crazy story?
Roland smiled bleakly. I don't think his belief would be an issue, Eddie. Because, think thee a moment, how much of our crazy story has Aaron Deepno actually heard?
Not enough, Eddie agreed.
He closed his eyes and pressed the heels of his hands against them, hard.
I can only think of one person who could actually convince Moses Carver to do the things we'd have to ask, and she's otherwise occupied. In the year of 99. And by then, Carver's going to be as dead as Deepno and maybe Tower himself.
Well, what can we do without her? What will satisfy you?
Eddie was thinking that perhaps Susanna could come back to 1977 without them, since she, at least, hadn't visited it yet.
Well, she'd come here toe-dash, but he didn't think that exactly counted.
He supposed she might be barred from 1977 solely on the grounds that she was quartet with him and Roland, or some other grounds.
Eddie didn't know.
Reading the fine print had never been his strong point. He turned to ask Roland what he thought, but Roland spoke before he got a chance.
"What about our Dan Titi?" he asked.
Although Eddie understood the term, it meant baby god or little savior, he did not at first understand what Roland meant by it.
Then he did.
Had not their Waterford Dan Titi loaned them the very car they were sitting in, say thank you?
Cullum? Is that who you're talking about, Roland? The guy with the case of autographed baseballs?
You say true, Roland replied.
He spoke in that dry tone which indicated not amusement but mild exasperation.
Don't overwhelm me with your enthusiasm for the idea.
But you told him to go away. And he agreed to go.
And how enthusiastic would you say he was about visiting his friend in Vermont?
Mont, Eddie said, unable to suppress a smile. Yet smiling or not, what he felt most strongly was dismay. He thought that ugly scraping sound he heard in his imagination was Roland's two-fingered right hand prospecting around at the very bottom of the barrel. Roland shrugged, as if to say he didn't care if Cullum had spoken of going to Vermont, or Barony, or Garland.
Answer my question.
Well, Cullum actually hadn't expressed much enthusiasm for the idea at all. He had from the very first reacted more like one of them than one of the grass-eaters among whom he lived. Eddie recognized grass-eaters very easily, having been one himself, until Roland first kidnapped him and then began his homicidal lessons. Cullum had been clearly intrigued by the gunslingers and curious about their business in his little town, but Roland had been very emphatic about what he wanted, and folks had a way of following his orders. Now he made a twirling motion with his right hand, his old impatient gesture.
Hurry, for your father's sake, shit or get off the commode.
I guess he really didn't want to go, Eddie said, but that doesn't mean he's still at his house in East Stoneham.
He is, though. He didn't go.
Eddie managed to keep his mouth from dropping open, only with some effort.
How can you know that? Can you touch him, is that it?
Roland shook his head.
Then how?
Ka.
Ka? Ka? Just what the fuck does that mean?
Roland's face was haggard and tired, the skin pale beneath his tan.
Who else do we know in this part of the world?
No one, but
then it's him.
Roland spoke flatly, as if stating some obvious fact of life for a child. Up is over your head, down is where your feet stick to the earth. Eddie got ready to tell him that was stupid, nothing more than rank superstition, then didn't. Putting aside Deepno, Tower, Stephen King, and the hideous Jack Andolini, John Cullum was the only person they knew in this part of the world. Or on this level of the Tower, if you preferred to think of it that way. And after the things Eddie had seen in the last few months, hell, in the last week, who was he to sneer at superstition?
All right, Eddie said. I guess we better try it.
How do we get in touch?
We can phone him from Bridgeton. But in a story, Roland, a minor character like John Cullum would never come in off the bench to save the day. It wouldn't be considered realistic.
In life, Roland said, I'm sure it happens all the time.
And Eddie laughed.
What the hell else could you do?
It was just so perfectly Roland.